compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. I got to tell you how much I love my job because I get to spend time with you. Thank you for that. It's a gift, really. My number is 888-914-9149. Let's get over to the phones now. Let's go to Leslie in St. Charles, Illinois. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Patrick.
Hi there.
My question was regarding music. So I listened to Taylor Swift when I was growing up, and I really liked her. And recently she came out, you know, in the music, I've always thought it was, you know, pretty clean, nothing bad. And she came out with a video where she's like wearing the devil's horns, and there's like people around her, they kind of look like it's like demons. And I just wanted to get, you know, I would definitely not go to her concerts or anything, but should I stop listening to her music?
Well, I wouldn't say definitely stop listening to her music, but I would definitely not listen to or watch music that's like that. I mean, if you're talking about like videos, I assume it's a video online.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it because I really don't watch videos, but I just saw like a clip of that scene.
Yeah, I would encourage you to avoid anything like that. And the Bible says, test all things, hold fast to that which is good. And that's not an absolute way of examining this question, but I think it's helpful to consider that perhaps there are some of her songs that are fine, and you're not listening to her songs because you are endorsing her personal life or her personal beliefs. I like Cat Stevens' music, but he's a Muslim now. I totally don't agree with him on that, but when I listen to Cat Stevens' music, I don't feel guilty because I don't feel like I'm somehow buying into his religious decisions. But, you know, you can appreciate her music for what it is if it's good, but by all means, I would filter out and stay away from anything like this. I mean, you have to ask yourself, why is that stuff in there? What is the message she's trying to send? And I don't know the first thing about Taylor Swift. I don't know her music at all. I know who she is. I mean, you can't help but seeing her everywhere. She's all over the place. But what message is she sending? I think it's pretty obvious that there's a certain fascination that people have now with the devil. And more and more of it seems to be coming into the mainstream. That's very disturbing. And all the more reason to avoid it. Now, some people might say, well, young lady, because she has this as one of her 101 songs, you shouldn't listen to any of it. I don't hold that view. But it's like anything else, Leslie. I'm sure you're careful about what food you eat, right? You're careful about what you put into your body by way of food because you don't want to harm your health, right? Which is more important? Your bodily health or your soul's health?
Yeah, your soul, definitely.
Yeah. So if we treated our souls, our minds, you know, what we consume with our eyes and what we listen to, if you treat your soul with the same level of vigilance or greater than you are when you decide what to eat and what not to eat, you're not going to be falling into sin and straying away from the Lord, you're going to be coming closer to Him. And like anything else, what we allow ourselves to see has an effect on us. Like the old saying goes, you are what you eat. So if you eat a steady diet of things that are bad for you, your health will suffer. It could even kill you. So in the same way, you are what you eat spiritually. And if you're eating, consuming, listening to, watching, looking at things that are harming you, well, it'll have its effect. So personally, I would avoid anything that even remotely was problematic like that.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And thank you for the phone call. I know I've mentioned this before, but this seems like an opportune time to mention it again. There have been songs that I've liked and then later on thought about them and thought, why am I listening to this song? I can't listen to this song anymore. And I've had to just simply cut them out. Even though I liked them, I liked the music or I liked the, you know, the beat or whatever, I just won't listen to it. There are a couple of Beatles songs I absolutely will not listen to. I like the Beatles an awful lot, but I won't listen to those songs because of what's in them. So it's kind of like that. You have to be discriminating. So those are my thoughts, 888-914-9149. How about Mark now in Eureka? Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question for you. I got to tell you, though, Billy Joel's Only the Good Die Young, I mean, it's such a finger-snapping, toe-tapping song, yeah. But the lyrics, man,
they're terrible. They're just, come on, Virginia. You Catholic girls, I know that song. And that's one of the songs I won't listen to either for that reason.
The only way I could turn it around is say maybe this is a guy singing his testimony and he ended up marrying Virginia and she converted him or something. But there's, So my question is, how would you compare Romans 5:14 with 1 Timothy 2:14?
Let me get the first one. So Romans 5:14, okay.
Yeah.
And then 1 Timothy 2:14?
Yeah. They're specifically, you'll see, that it may appear that the transgression, it appears that it contradicts itself because the transgression is upon the one in one passage and then it's upon the other in the other passage. And I know that...
I see exactly what you mean. Let me read them for the sake of people who aren't familiar with those. So Romans 5:14, yet death reigned from Adam to Moses, even over those whose sins were not like the transgression of Adam, who was a type of the one who was to come. That's referring to Jesus. But the free gift is not like the trespass. For if many died through one man's trespass, much more have the grace of God and the free gift in the grace of that one man, Jesus Christ, abounded for many. So that's the Romans 5:14 and 15 passage. 1 Timothy 2:14 says, and it was not Adam who was deceived by Satan. The woman was deceived and the sin was the result, and sin was the result. Okay. I see what looks like a potential contradiction, but I would harmonize it this way. Eve, as it says in verse 13, actually, if we go a little further up, he's talking about the role of women in the church, such things as, you know, he begins in verse 9, I want women to be modest in their appearance. They should wear decent and appropriate clothing and not draw attention to themselves by the way they fix their hair or by wearing gold or pearls or expensive clothes. And then he continues to talk about the role of women, submission. I do not let a woman teach or have authority over men. Let them listen quietly. Then he says in verse 13, for God made Adam first, and afterward he made Eve. And it was not Adam who was deceived by Satan. The woman was deceived. So the thrust of this point here is that, and I hate to put it in these terms, but I think this is really what he is saying here, that Eve was gullible in a way that Adam wasn't, and that Eve was beguiled by the serpent in the garden. And then he, Adam, he wasn't beguiled by Eve. He wasn't befuddled or any of the other terms that we might use for that. He had a clarity of thinking that made his sin all the worse, and it was him as the head of the family that his sin is what caused all the dominoes to fall over. So it actually, in this, as I read it, it reinforces Romans 5:14. It reinforces the fact that in verse 12, original sin came from Adam, not from Eve. Eve was a participant. She was an accomplice, that's for sure. But Adam's act of falling is what started this terrible process. And so when you look at the two passages side by side, he's kind of making the same point by saying Eve was not the head of the family. She wasn't the head of the human race. She didn't have authority in the way that Adam did. And so he was not deceived. He did it with full deliberation. She was deceived. She was, she was beguiled, to use the term again, and Adam wasn't. And that's what made his sin all the more malicious, is because he was clear-headed about it in a way that Eve apparently wasn't. That's how I read it. So it seems that not only is it harmonious, but the one passage supports the other, or actually sort of amplifies what it's saying. What are your thoughts, Mark?
I've tried to wrap my head, and I understand a bit. I bounce around. I'm sure I think you're familiar with the textual critic, Bart Ehrman, and he suggested that whole passage in Timothy was added in because it has a misogynistic tone that wasn't in his other writings. Yeah. And I know I have a friend who does the same thing because he's a big calendar guy, and Colossians says don't fight over the first crescent. And he says, well, that's probably added in later. So there's this tendency maybe to do this with Paul and say, it's all the same author. It should absolutely jibe. And if it doesn't, it's probably added in. I don't know. That's maybe one explanation. But I've also heard Protestants say, well, sin didn't happen until Adam. That doesn't quite make sense to me either. I don't know. I understand that Eve was tempted and Adam wasn't deceived. And I often think maybe Adam's sin was thinking God didn't have faith that God wouldn't make him another wife, you know, that he didn't have faith. Whereas the first commandment spoken about man was that it's not good for him to be alone. So, you know, maybe he should have just said, that's it. You know, I can't do it. I'm sorry you did, but I can't follow you. And that was what he should have done. And unfortunately for Eve, she would have been cast out and he would have been given a new wife. I don't know what to think. So
my first word of caution would be pay no attention to Bart Ehrman. He's not a trustworthy exegete. He's the last on the list of people I would look to for exegetical advice. If you consult what St. Thomas says on this issue, so it's in the second part of the second part, question 163, the first man's sin. And article 4 is, who sinned more grievously, the man or the woman? And he explains this. He says, punishment corresponds to guilt. Now, the woman was more grievously punished than the man, as appears from Genesis 3. Therefore, she sinned more grievously than the man. He says, the gravity of a sin depends on the species rather than on a circumstance of that sin. Accordingly, we must assert that if we consider the condition attaching to these persons, Adam and Eve, the man's sin is more grievous because he was more perfect than the woman. That's what I was referring to there. Then it gets into the question of the genus of sin. The sin of each is considered to be equal, for each sinned by pride. And as St. Augustine says, Eve, in excusing herself, betrays disparity of sex through parity of pride. What he's saying there is that there is a disparity in a certain way between men and women, but they are equal when it comes to their ability to be prideful. Then he gets into the third aspect of it with regard to the species of pride. The woman sinned more grievously for three reasons, he says. First, because she was more puffed up than the man, for the woman believed in the serpent's persuasive words, namely that God had forbidden them to eat of the tree, lest they should become like to him, so that in wishing to attain God's likeness by eating of the forbidden fruit, her pride, rose to the height of desiring to obtain something against God's will. On the other hand, the man did not believe this to be true, wherefore he did not wish to attain God's likeness against God's will, but his pride consisted in wishing to attain thereto by his own power. Secondly, the woman not only herself sinned, but suggested sin to the man. Wherefore, she sinned against God and her neighbor. Thirdly, he says, the man's sin was diminished by the fact that, as Augustine says, he consented to the sin out of a certain friendly goodwill, on account of which a man sometimes will offend God rather than make an enemy of his friend. That he ought not to have done so is shown by the just issue of the divine sentence. So he, as you can see here, he takes an exacto knife to this passage, and he just slices and dices and gets at the really specific elements of it. And it's certainly not just one thing. But if you're interested, that might be something, Mark, to ponder and kind of go through with St. Thomas as he looks at these passages point by point.
Okay. Does it, Does it consider also how they deal? Maybe you went through this and I missed it, but how they dealt with the blame? Because if man and woman was made in his image, and when they say made a male and female, mm-hmm. and Adam tends to point to Eve, but then Eve turns and points to a serpent. Whatever mm-hmm. the serpent Nahash was before, he wasn't crawling around on the ground yet, but the serpent supposedly wasn't made in the image of God. So does that make it worse that she'd say, well, the serpent said? And
I don't think so, because we have to back up a step. The reason I interrupt you is because the meaning of that phrase, to be made in God's image and likeness, the image has nothing to do with the type of body, because obviously God doesn't have a body. It has to do with the intellect and a will. God knows and loves, and we are made in his image in that, unlike the lower animals, we have a rational intellect and a will. And so for that reason, we are like God. So that's what it means to be made in his image. Being made in his likeness has to do with something else. That has to do with his holiness. But so no, I don't think there's anything there with regard to the shape of the serpent compared to the shape or the body type of the human beings. Is that what you were saying? Or maybe I misunderstood you.
No, I didn't mean the shape, but the serpent wasn't a man or a woman, probably didn't have that image, right? Or, I mean, I guess we don't know. I just thought that whatever the likeness, or excuse me, the image was, it was obviously the serpent wasn't made in the image. So she took the advice of something that wasn't, I don't know, maybe if that had something to do with, you know, the fact that she blamed something that wasn't even, I don't know what I'm talking, I don't even know what the serpent was doing there in the first place. So, you know what I mean? It's just, I thought maybe that was a, you know, like I remember being told as a kid, he did it, or he told me to do it. And the teacher would say, if he told you to jump off the GW bridge, would you do it? You know? So mm-hmm. There's that thing. Well, but this is a serpent and I know he's wise. And
well, this is the form that the fallen angel took. In other words, the devil isn't a serpent. He doesn't have a body. He's a pure spirit. And and yet to appear to Adam and Eve and to converse with them, he took this form as it's described. But this is what I meant by body type. He's not an animal. He's not a serpent. He's a pure spirit. So the form that he took in the garden, or the account of it, is, to my mind, it's inconsequential to this particular question. Because you'll notice it in Genesis 3, God refers to him being cursed among all the other animals, and you'll have to crawl on your belly. So it kind of suggests that whatever form of a dragon or a serpent of some sort, that he wasn't before that point crawling on his belly. And obviously, as soon as this was over, the devil probably relinquished that bodily form that he appeared in, and went back to his normal nature of being a pure spirit. And it's not that he stopped being a pure spirit and had to resume that. I don't mean it in that sense. But go ahead, Mark.
Do you think that the serpent then could have been taken by Eve as an angel from God, or somebody to be trusted, or represented as a man, another man, or something that she might have thought.
Are you suggesting that she was willing to be seduced by the serpent? Is that what you mean?
Well, yeah, or sometimes Satan casts doubt in our minds to say, well, maybe you don't know the commandment as well as you think you do, and teases you with your base lusts or whatever, what have you, and you think, you know, he confuses you. That's why.
Yeah, he does do that. Jesus says that the devil is a liar and the father of lies and a murderer. So we know that much to be true. Hey, Mark, I've got to run. Thank you for the interesting conversation. Aha! Cat Stevens, before he became a Muslim, by the way. I'll be right back. Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners access to free online classes at getprinciples.com/truth. Acclaimed philosopher Dr. John Cutteback is teaching a class now, Understanding Human Nature, at getprinciples.com/truth.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right, let's get back to those phones. Mike in San Diego, thank you for calling. Welcome.
Good morning, Patrick. So I think I have a fairly simple question, and what's driving this is I'm reading a book called Purgatory, which is a collection of testimonies from different saints and whatnot. And in it, it obviously talks about purgatory. It talks about indulgences and plenary indulgences, which I don't fully understand. And so that's the heart of my question. Are those two different things? And what are they?
Let's start there. Why don't we pause
How do we know that it's real?
Okay. Yeah, why don't we pause there? Okay, so what? First of all, what is an indulgence? An indulgence is the church applying the merits of Jesus Christ and all the body of Christ, so the Blessed Virgin Mary and all the saints, to you to remit whatever need you may have to do penance for your sins that have been forgiven, either partially or entirely. So a plenary indulgence is where this remission is entire. So any and all penance you might need to do for the sins in your life that have been forgiven. Now, we're not talking about the penalty due to the sin. Only Jesus can pay the penalty by his death on the cross. But sin has an effect on you. It has what's called temporal effects. And analogies might be helpful here. It could be, you think of it as a stain or a scar, things like that. So the sin has its effects. And those effects are expiated through penance, almsgiving, prayers, etc. So in the case of a plenary indulgence, the church entirely remits, and this is with the authority that Christ gave, whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. So the church, in essence, is loosing you from the need to do penance for those sins that have been forgiven by applying the merits of Christ and the body of Christ to you. That's a plenary indulgence. And a partial indulgence is the other kind, and that means that a portion of those of that penance that might need to be done has been remitted. There's no exact figure or amount. Sometimes you might have seen holy cards or something from, I don't know, 50, 60, 100 years ago that would say 3 years indulgence or 100 days indulgence, that kind of thing. And often people misunderstood that to mean that that takes off 3 years of purgatory or 100 days of purgatory, and it never meant that. It was referring to this would be the equivalent of if you had done 3 years worth of penance in this life. So in order to make it more understandable for people, the church just simply said a partial indulgence or a plenary indulgence. So that's what it is, and that's what it does. Did that get the first question satisfied?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. So I think you were going on to another question.
Well, and you might have answered that too. So, okay. Because the heart of it was, well, how do we know this, and where is it coming from? But you did kind of answer that. Mm-hmm. But it did make me think of one other thing. Your answer.
Sure. Okay.
So, let's say that somebody is oblivious to the idea of indulgences, but they're still living a faithful life, going to Mass, praying, receiving the sacraments. Do the rules that you just kind of walked us through, mm-hmm. do those apply regardless if somebody knows they're getting quote-unquote credit?
I'm not sure if I understand the question. Could you restate it? Do what rules apply exactly?
Well, does the idea of a plenary indulgence take place regardless if the person knows that they're getting it? You know what I mean?
Oh, in other words, does a person have to know about indulgences to receive one? Is that what you mean?
Exactly. That's right.
Okay. So the answer is yes, because you have to desire it. You have to want it. You have to desire it. Now, some might say, well, you could have an implicit desire for all of God's blessings, even if you don't have an explicit desire for it. And I can see the point there, but in order to receive the indulgence in any case, there are certain requirements. So the act itself, whatever the indulgence act is, praying the rosary as a group, let's say, I don't know if many people know this. If you say the rosary in a group prayerfully, there's a plenary indulgence attached to that. And that's a very common thing that one could do, and many people don't realize that. And there are so many other things. This is why I'm going to kind of skip ahead to the end of our conversation, Mike, and just say there's a great book that you would enjoy called The Handbook of Indulgences, Norms, and Grants that lays everything out in one book. It's really good. It includes a lot of prayers and things. But to go back to your question, you have to have the intention to gain the indulgence, and you also have to perform the requirements. So the prayer itself, for example, and then you also have to be free from all attachment to sin, and you have to receive, typically, under most circumstances, you would have to go to Mass and receive communion and go to confession within 8 days before or after the indulgence act. And then in some cases, there are also prayers for the Holy Father. You have to do that. So absent those things, the person wouldn't gain the indulgence, if that's what you're asking me.
Yes, and you answered that question.
Okay. Yeah, you're asking a really good question or a series of questions that I really believe you'd enjoy this book. It's published by the Catholic Book Publishing Company. It's a rather slim book. It only runs to maybe, 121 pages. It's a hardcover book, quite nice, The Handbook of Indulgences, Norms, and Grants. And there's so much in here. I have a feeling you'll find it very interesting. Thanks for the call, Mike. Appreciate that. Let's go now to Barbara in New Jersey. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. So I'm calling because I have twin 7-year-old girls, and I'm in the car listening to Relevant Radio, taking them to and from school, mm-hmm. and abortion comes up, and I just don't know how to explain that to a 7-year-old. If they ever ask me, I don't know what to say it is.
Yeah. Are they in the car with you now?
No, they're not. They're at school.
Okay, good. It's tough because how do you, I guess I'm repeating your question rhetorically. How do you reveal to an innocent little child that there are human beings, adults out there, who would willingly kill an unborn baby? It's just so unthinkable, especially to a child of that age. It's so unthinkable. So,
exactly.
My advice would be, maybe just don't bother with this until they ask about it. And if it,
well,
you know,
I'm not going to bring it up, but I just meant like if they do bring it up, if they do say to me, Mommy, what is that? What does that mean?
Yeah. Well, then I guess you would say, well, it's a really bad thing. It's a really sad thing. But there are some people who they think it would be better for the baby to die. And so they either give the mom this bad medicine, a chemical that will kill the baby inside, or even worse, they will perform an operation to kill the baby that way. And isn't that terrible? And isn't that horrible? You know, how could anybody do that to reinforce their natural instinctive recognition that unborn babies should never be treated that way? And it's a shame that we have to talk to our children about this, but you're right, sooner or later, they're going to ask about it. I wish that we could preserve their innocence longer. But
yeah,
I think that's the way to say it.
Okay. All right. Thank you for explaining it.
You're welcome. I wish I had something happier to tell you, but, you know.
Me too, but.
Nancy and I had to go through that with our children as they grew up. We had to explain it to them, and it was painful for us to have to reveal that to them.
Okay, well
thanks,
you for
Barbara.
Explaining it.
You're welcome. Thank you. Appreciate the call. Let's go now to Margaret in Covina, California. Hello, Margaret.
Hi. Thursday blessings to you, Patrick.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I have a question. I was going through, my mom has this old suitcase of memorabilia in there, like a lot of old pictures, certificates, mm-hmm. and things like that. And in there was a card, and on the top was written ejaculations. And then below that were prayers with numbers next to them. So like Hail Mary 10, Our Father 10. And it looked like this was given to her for, I think it was an anniversary or something.
Okay.
So I wanted to know if you knew what that was.
Yeah. So when you say they had a number next to it, like 10, any indication like, what that was like referring to?
Like 10 Hail Marys. 10, almost like a spiritual bouquet. So like maybe 10 Our
okay.
Fathers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So that sounds like a spiritual bouquet where you would say, I'm going to offer for your intention this many Hail Marys or this many rosaries or this many mass intentions. That's how a spiritual bouquet typically is put together. So maybe that's what these cards were for. You say this was a card, like a card you would send somebody?
It's a little, almost looks like a business card. Okay. And it was really pretty writing, fancy print. It maybe looked like something that you would fill out.
Yeah.
And so, but at the top, in cursive, you know, like script writing, it was blue and white, actually. It was a white card with blue, pretty blue writing mm-hmm. in it that ejaculations.
Right. And it's an unfortunate reality that that word means something, in more commonly means something that has nothing to do with this. That term refers to prayers in the moment. So like if you just, in your heart, suddenly you're praising God, or you're saying, you know, Jesus and Mary, I love you, or Jesus, Mary, save souls, things like that. That term was used to describe that type of extemporaneous type of prayer, but thankfully it's no longer really used very often anymore, at least not in that context, for obvious reasons. But that sounds like what this is, a prayer card that you could fill in and say, I'm going to do these many prayers of this type, or this particular prayer. And it may be something that was given as a gift for First Communion or confirmation or something like that. That's what it sounds like to me.
I see. Okay. Yeah, I kind of thought maybe that's what it was. I had never heard that term used for like spontaneous prayer.
Right.
But it did look like it was a gift, and it looked like a pre-printed card. So I had just wondered if that was a thing.
Yeah.
That used to be a thing that people would do. If I think of you, I'm going to say 10 Hail Marys for your intentions or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was much more common then. And that term was commonly used in that way. But like with any living language, words take on new and different meanings. And that word has a much different meaning in the popular mind
sure.
than extemporaneous prayers. But you get the idea.
Yeah, okay, great. All right, well, that clears it up. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Nice chatting with you. Let's go to Antonia now in Indianapolis. Good morning, Antonia.
Good morning. I was calling because I had seen several obituaries in our diocese where a nun who works in a parish is listed as officiating a funeral at a funeral home.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought funerals for Catholics could only be done by priests. So I was wondering what the church's stance on people who weren't priests officiating funerals for Catholics was.
Well, this is something that would be said explicitly one way or the other in the rite of funerals, which is the order of that particular ritual. And I don't have that book in my studio to be able to refer to it. So I'll say what I think the answer is, but if you want to know specifically, that book is going to have it. And that is that the ordinary minister of these liturgical functions would be a Catholic priest. In some cases, a deacon can fulfill that role, and this is one of them. So deacons can certainly preside over funerals. And you're talking about at the gravesite, right? Or are you referring to the rite in the church?
At the funeral home, the service is being held at the funeral home, and the sister is the one presiding over mm-hmm. the service at the funeral home.
Got it. Yeah. So this is a technical question that I don't have the answer for. And I'm sure somebody somewhere is sitting down to the email right now to tell me what it is. I would need to consult that book in order to know. And of course, the church's law is also going to have something on that as well. I'm just looking to see if the National Catholic Bishops Conference has anything on their website, and they may. I just don't see that. So let me take a rain check on this one. I will do some homework. I'll find out an answer for you, and I'll let you know. But in the meantime, just as a general rule, there are circumstances that are extraordinary or unusual where a lay person or a religious sister could be called upon to do something like that. But under the ordinary circumstances, the ordinary minister of these types of liturgical rites would be the priest, could be a deacon, and of course it could be a bishop. So maybe what you're referring to is something that happened because there was no priest, no deacon available to do this, and it needed to be done. I don't know if it's that kind of an unusual situation, but I'm going to check on that, and I'll come back with an answer.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome, Antonio. Thank you. Well, this would be a good time to take a break. We'll do that and come right back. The number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Plenty of your phone calls and emails right ahead, right after this. Our sponsor, Christendom College, offers our listeners access to free online classes at getprinciples.com/truth. Acclaimed philosopher Dr. John Cutteback is teaching a class now, Understanding Human Nature, at getprinciples.com/truth.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
All right, we are back. This is the Patrick Madrid Show. Thank you for listening. 888-914-9149. We're going out to Mary in Spring, Texas. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Patrick. How are you?
I am well, thank you.
Thank you. Patrick, I was reading through the Catechism with Father Mike, and I am catching up, but I was reading the part about apostolic societies, secular institutes, consecrated widows and virgins, and I'm having some difficulty understanding this. So can you give me some examples or tell me the difference between apostolic societies and secular institutes and those individuals who take vows?
Okay, I'll try. This is a canon law question, and I'm not a canon lawyer, so I'm going to tell you what I think the answer is, but definitely consult a canon lawyer if you have some like need to know more precisely. These are terms that are used to describe, I think, what are called juridical persons. So it doesn't have to be a human person, but a juridical person, a parish, for example, a diocese, an institute, things like that. And there are different levels of recognition, or maybe a different way to put it would be different levels of being official in the eyes of the church. And so, like, you could have a pious association of the faithful, you could have, and that would be more ad hoc. It would be more, let's put it this way, less structured and less governed by the church's law. And then as you move up into those more specific or more official or more formal kinds of statuses, there's more and more law that applies, more oversight, more governance on the part of the church. So it would be, I think, easy if you were to go to the Code of Canon Law, you could do it online, and look up that particular term. So what was the one that you gave me a minute ago? You gave me two or three examples. Well, what would those be? Give me another example.
Well, the Catechism also referred to consecrated widows and virgins, but I want to just, if you don't mind, I'd like to just set that question aside, mm-hmm. And ask for for some examples of an apostolic society or a secular institute, like Opus Dei. Is that an apostolic society, a secular institute? I'm having difficulty determining the difference between those, and I'm just curious.
Sure. Yeah, and curiosity is good. So this is a question I can't answer for you because I'm sure there's some precise classification that Opus Dei has. I know it's a personal prelature, so that means that it is not restricted to a geographical region like a diocese is. And there's a prelate who oversees Opus Dei. Historically, not all of them, but several of them have been bishops. But as I understand it, the Pope recently said that from this point forward, they won't be made bishops. Whoever the prelate is will be a prelate in a canonical sense, but won't be a bishop. So they have a kind of universal territory anywhere in the world, wherever they may be. They're not subject to the diocese. They're supposed to cooperate, obviously, but their governance comes from the prelate who oversees that personal prelature. So to what extent is it exactly classified as a secular institute? Those are questions I don't have the answer to. A canon lawyer would be able to tell you that.
Okay. And so then, if I can ask one last question, I promise it will be the last. So there was some discussion in the catechism about consecrated widows and virgins. And so I get the sense from reading that particular paragraph, and I'm sorry, I don't have my catechism in front of me, that that is not necessarily formal vows or formal consecration in public, but more of a personal consecration. Would that be right?
Right. Yes, exactly. So there, let's take a consecrated widow, or in the case of a consecrated virgin who was never married, it's an arrangement that she has with the bishop of the diocese, typically, in which he permits her to live a life that's consecrated to the Lord, and she's celibate, and she may or may not live in community, but she doesn't take formal vows. She doesn't pronounce vows the way a religious sister would. She might even maintain a job or do something else. Maybe she would do some work for the diocese or something. But it's a separate status that is, in some ways, is similar to religious life. But in other ways, she's not in a religious community. She's not under religious vows. But the bishop has permitted her to live a life like that. So it's a different, similar, but a different canonical situation for her. A religious sister would be in a different canonical situation than a consecrated virgin would.
Okay. And so I am curious why nuns as consecrated women take a different name, but priests as consecrated men generally do not.
Well, if we're talking about religious life for the men, they very often do take a different name in religion. They're not required to. I mean, maybe they are in some religious orders to take a different name and renounce their name in the world. But that's not always the case. I know that the Dominican friars, for example, they can take a religious name and it's encouraged, but they're not required to do so. It's very common though.
Okay.
Now in the case of religious sisters, they too, if they're obviously in religious life, and that would be governed by their order. And if the order has this as a requirement or a custom, then they would do that. But I don't think that they would have to do that. Now, outside of religious life, you can have a diocesan priest who's not, he's not consecrated in the sense that we think of a religious brother or even a religious priest or a religious sister, because they're under vows in a religious order. That's different from the secular clergy. So in the case of, let's say, Father McGillicuddy at St. Miscellaneous Parish, he's a diocesan priest. He's not under religious vows. He makes promises to the bishop when he's ordained, but he doesn't have the vows of religious life. So for that matter, not that you asked me this question, but just to add this in there, a diocesan priest can own his own home. He can have a second home. He can have his own things because he's not under a vow of poverty the way a religious is. So there's certain things that one can do that the other can't. But a diocesan priest is not consecrated in that sense. So he doesn't have to take any... diocesan priests don't take a new name. When they're ordained, they just keep their legal name, their baptismal name.
Right. Okay. Well, this makes me think that I need to do more reading, because you've opened up some things that make me have other questions, but I don't want to hog your time. So, okay, that was interesting. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, you're most welcome. And I don't at all feel like you're hogging my time. I'm here for this. I'm here to try to help if I can. So I hope that these other questions are ones that you find good answers for. Now, the Code of Canon Law is available online. It's searchable if you want to kind of do a keyword search. There are also, and I think I mentioned this yesterday or the day before, Mary, there are websites devoted to canon law. One is called Canon Law Made Easy. And there are lots and lots of articles there written by this canon lawyer, Kathy Caridi. So you might go there and do a keyword search and see if she's written articles about this.
Okay, well, busted, because I didn't finish listening to your podcast yesterday.
Okay. Well, all is forgiven. Just don't let it happen again.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mary. Nice chatting with you. 888-914-9149. How about George now in Creskill, New Jersey? Good morning, George.
Hey, good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. Actually, we are,
sure.
I got lucky and had a day off of work today because New York City's all smoked up, and so is New Jersey where I live. So
I saw that.
You know, yeah. I got some time to, it's pretty wild, actually. You know, yesterday around like 2 or 3 o'clock, it was super dark. I was like, it feels like I'm watching a movie, you know.
Yeah.
It's just
very eerie.
It's just unreal. Yeah, it's just strange, you know, and today is not, it's a little bit better, but, you know, thank goodness that my company decided to close and give us a day off, because it's definitely not healthy, that's for sure.
Yeah, I can imagine, yeah.
I have three beautiful children that I'm in love with, you know, and they're, you know, being a parent is one of the biggest obstacles of my life, and it's a challenge, you know, on its own. But why doesn't the Catholic Church do something as a whole where they are maybe help us to put our children in Catholic schools for people, for parents and families that can't afford to send them to a Catholic school but want to but don't have the choice because, you know, they just can't afford it?
Right.
Is there something that you might know of, or that is, you know, because I believe me, Patrick, I want to take my kids to Catholic school, and it's just so hard because, you know, we pay a lot of taxes for where we live, and mm-hmm. the public schools are amazing. They're blue ribbon schools, but, you know, I just feel like there's some things that are missing that they don't learn there that they would be learning in a Catholic school. And, you know, it's just something where I just don't understand if the, you know, Christianity.
I understand.
I
have an answer for you. Some dioceses and some parishes do exactly that. They do either give free tuition or dramatically subsidized tuition. And usually it's if you're a member of the parish, you have dramatically subsidized tuition. And I've known some parishes where it's free. If you're a member of the parish, then tuition at their parish school is free. So it does happen. It's not common, but it does happen. And my understanding is that it's a matter of economics. So in parishes or dioceses where they've got the wherewithal to make this available, they do so. Most don't do so, and probably because they don't have the wherewithal to do it. So it's an unfortunate situation for those who would like to send their children to Catholic school, but they can't afford it. And I know that that's got to be very frustrating for you. But at the same time, there are alternatives. So I don't know if you're a two-income family. I don't know if your wife is working outside the home. But homeschooling your kids is another viable option. And they can get at least as good of a Catholic education in some ways if you were doing homeschooling. So that's another option. Have you looked into that?
Yeah, I've looked into that also, but you know, unfortunately, me and my wife, you know, we both have to work just because it's just kind of challenging, you know, to do one paycheck, let alone two these days. But I just, you know, when we go to Mass on Sundays, you know, the priest always talks about, bring your kids to, bring your kids to church, teach them about this, teach them about that. And, you know, he's not just speaking to us, but just as a whole, you know, and this is something that is not just at the church, but in other places where we have gatherings and talk about these kind of things. But it's just easier said than done. And I feel like, you know, us as Catholics, there's so many millions and millions of us all around the world. And I just wish that Rome or our Pope would do something to kind of figure something out where we can send our kids to a Catholic school and it'll be okay.
Well, it's a good topic for prayer, right? Good intention to pray for. Thanks, George. I appreciate it. I'll be right back right after this.